From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Brooke Gladstone's latest book gets right to the point. It's not even 100 pages. She wrote it in 2 weeks as a way of responding to the panic, the befuddlement, the astonishment some people felt about Donald Trump actually getting elected. It not only threw certain people off, Gladstone says, it shattered their worldview, and she was one of them. She admits in the book the fact people actually voted for Trump was inconceivable to her. And in fact, she says, this is the place to begin a reckoning with how we all perceive reality and truth. So the book is a philosophical rumination then about why this moment feels different and how you paste a shattered sense of reality back together. Brooke Gladstone today, after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Salt Lake County Animal Services, a no-kill municipal shelter specializing in pet adoptions, licensing, humane education, and more. Located at 511 West, 3900 South in Salt Lake City. More information is at AdoptUtahPets.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In her latest book, which is so short it's maybe more an essay than a book, Brooke Gladstone says no American escaped the tremors that brought Donald Trump to the American presidency. A lot of people enjoyed the tremors, wanted a political upheaval. But she says more than half the nation suffered some degree of vertigo in November. As she put it in her book, it was as if reality was sucked into a black hole. And so, as she writes, what to do? If you're questioning reality, she says, the logical first step is to track it to its source. And that's what she does in this book/essay. She explores how we all construct our own personal realities. But this is also about lies and truth and the past, present, and future of journalism. Brooke Gladstone is the co-host and managing editor for WNYC Studios On the Media. Her book is The Trouble with Reality: Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. She joined us earlier this week from the studios of WNYC in New York City. I guess I wanted to start with your process for writing this book/essay. What was the thing that got you started thinking about it? How did these ideas come together that made you think, I need to work this out on paper?
As you know, as a reporter, a lot of times you don't really start thinking about things until somebody asks you to, and then you begin the process. And that's basically what happened here. Workman Publishing and the agent for WNYC showed up a couple of weeks after the election and said, we are hearing more or less a continuous high-pitched whine these days. The level of anxiety is so extreme, and I really think that we really think that you should address this. And I looked at them and said, the world is changing every news cycle. Yeah. If I write a book and you use your usual time to put books out, the book industry usually takes about 6 to 9 months to a year to actually get a book out, I said, it won't be relevant anymore. And I said, so I'll make this deal. I will write this in 2 weeks based on the thoughts that have been rattling around in my head if you promise to get it out in 2 months. And I did, and they did. And that was what started me. It was an assignment. And then it became a deep dive down a bunch of rabbit holes. As you know, from having read the book, it wanders all over the place, from John Milton to Hannah Arendt to any number of other people, Ursula Le Guin, Philip K. Dick, Aldous Huxley, Neil Postman, and so on. So it's kind of a trip through my brain in a way, but it's me trying hard to reckon with the question of why is this distress felt by arguably a little more than half the country different from the other times that people have not had elections go their way or found themselves working with a president they didn't respect. I mean, anybody who lives long enough knows that politics often doesn't go their way. But this level of distress felt far beyond politics.
Is that what you mean by moral panic?
Yeah. You know, it's a funny thing. As you also know, it's a very little book.
Yeah.
And And I didn't want to call it an argument or even a treatise. It's a rumination. So I called it a rumination on moral panic in our time. Moral panic and existential panic are the same thing. But people think that I'm talking about morality very specifically when I'm talking about something existential. But trying to fit the words rumination and existential in the same subtitle seemed to be going a bridge too far.
So the question, one of the questions anyway that you're getting at least related to reality, is, you know, what does that mean anymore? And you say that part of the problem is that in some ways facts no longer constitute reality. Explain that, because you write about our current circumstance and you say this, reality is personal.
Right. And actually, I argue that that's always been the case.
Yeah.
That facts only make up a fraction of our reality. You might consider it a kind of armature, but all the spaces in between are filled in by what I would call the unseen, our traditions, our values, our fundamental beliefs about how the world works, not even how it's supposed to work, just how it does work. And then all this stuff gets marinated, and what you end up with is your own handcrafted notion of reality. And there are as many of those as there are individuals on the planet. The difference is, of course, that there are certain areas of consensus. Yeah. And we think that we're in a red world, in a blue world, or we're in a liberal or conservative or what have you, whereas in reality, we are in each our own reality, which is its own shade, and either blends or clashes with the realities alongside them. And I argue that basically the beliefs of the losers here were, in many cases, shattered. And I don't mean, I mean the beliefs of how democracy works, how people process facts, all of that stuff that seemed to, that we, the beliefs about which we created a consistent, believable world, turned out to be just not true.
Yeah.
And then you have to pick up the pieces of that shattered reality.
Philip K. Dick was looking for an answer to the question of what is reality. And as you mentioned, he never really did find a good one. He came up with a kind of a short one, but it didn't really work all that well. But and he seemed to be saying, and this I found really interesting, Philip K. Dick seemed to be saying that at the heart of this question of what is reality is this idea of what it means to be, you know, authentically human, the definition of the authentic human.
Mm-hmm.
Explain what he meant by that.
It is a big concept, and he wrote about it in a book of nonfiction writings, that when the ether is filled with inauthentic stuff, I mean, facts that are wrong, narratives that are wrong, things that are designed to manipulate us or to motivate us to buy something, the way that our reality is manufactured creates reactions that are ultimately also manufactured. I mean, don't you find it kind of interesting that nowadays everybody is so familiar with the tropes of the man on the street that if you take your mic out onto the street and ask people for their opinion, they've already seemed to have the style down of the person on the street.
Yeah.
This is all part of living in our own worlds and having our own theme music playing in our heads and having that camera outside of ourselves. It's hard to respond spontaneously when you are continually watching yourself. And go to a museum. You see people taking pictures of pictures, but not really looking at the pictures.
Yeah.
The experience in the moment seems to be devalued in favor of preserving a moment that you will never go back and revisit because you didn't experience it to begin with.
Yeah.
I think all of those things have to do with what creates inauthentic humans who don't even know what a spontaneous reaction feels like.
The problem with our perception of reality, you're right, is naturally limited by our own, you know, field of vision. And the way we look at others is to imagine their lives on these very super shallow impressions, stereotypes, basically. And you write about stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And this is where the journalist Walter Lippmann comes in, who basically introduced this idea of stereotypes. And this is the thing that I found interesting about this, is that what's important about stereotypes isn't just the stereotypes we make about other people. It's the stereotypes of the way things work.
Right. Stereotyped ideas.
Yeah.
Not just people. This is how he applied the word. Nowadays, we wouldn't use stereotype that way, but he was the one who first used it in this sense, so I give him full props for it. And by the way, I'd recommend anybody who's interested in this topic, look up Public Opinion, written in the 20s by Walter Lippmann, and you'll be stunned by how current that seems today, even with all the revolutions in technology and media we've gone through. So what he said was that there was this stereotyped idea that technology would solve all of our problems. That was true when he was writing this. And so there were crucial things that people simply filtered out, failed to see. It had to do with the growing inequality between the owners of businesses that made things, technological businesses, and their workers. You could see what was happening to the environment, but that was filtered out because it was believed that the greater good would always be found in technology.
Right.
And on it, that was just an example of one stereotyped idea that caused some genuine problems in the long run because our vision was filtered in such a way that everything was basically filtered through that fundamental foundational belief, and anything that wasn't consistent with it was basically blocked out or sluiced off.
Yeah. So what was the stereotype that we held before November of 2016?
For those who are currently now in a state of existential panic, you mean?
Yeah. Yes.
I would say that one is that democracy in itself had enough protections in it to prevent it being subverted by somebody who was fundamentally anti-democratic, that we had enough checks and balances and corrections. Now, this remains to be seen, but we believed that we could elect people and those elections would, even though there were always irregularities and famous irregularities in any number of past elections, that ultimately, the people would elect their choice, and their choice would fundamentally respect the norms of our democracy, that it was a self-propelling system. I think that belief has come to be shattered. The belief that if you put falsehood and truth in the same room and had them battle it out, then the truth would always emerge victorious. That's a fairly naive and old belief, but somehow we have to believe that in order for our world to work, that facts will always prevail over lies.
This is one thing you also say, is that there basically is no cure for stereotyping. It's kind of baked into who we are. So do you even believe people can come away from these polls and find some kind of objective reality that we can all agree on?
Well, I do. Now, in terms of stereotypes and the building of these realities to begin with, which is much more an enterprise of filtering than it is of incorporating ideas and thoughts from other places. It's about keeping our worlds consistent. We have to do that because the world is altogether too complex for us to grasp in its entirety. We would be paralyzed by it. These shortcuts are absolutely necessary, and I don't argue that we can ever, ever transcend them. But I do believe that we can broaden them. I think that we can put ourselves in the way of information and ideas that challenge that reality if we understand how difficult it truly is.
Yeah.
The fact is that we are wired to reduce panic, reduce the kind of queasiness and almost nauseation that comes from having our fundamental beliefs challenged. And we will retreat if we respond with any degree of, as I say, spontaneity. We have to work against our wiring for that to happen. And so a big part of the book is simply laying out why we are the way we are.
Right.
So we understand what we're up against when we try and build realities that more resemble the outside world and thereby are more durable and less likely to be involved in multi-reality smash-ups that leave people crawling away amid the shards trying to figure out how to paste it all back together.
Right.
Is that gory and involved enough for you?
Enough. Absolutely. And it seems like also just being willing, and this actually seemed to me, Brooke, like a theme in the book. An important part of overcoming these blind spots, you say, is just accepting that they exist.
Mm-hmm.
Ursula Le Guin put it this way. This is how you quote her. You learn the unanswerable questions, but not try to answer them. Like, that seems like a theme here. Just we need to realize this is not tidy. This is all of these blind spots are baked into who we are. So the, one of the first steps into sort of coming to some kind of sense of who we are is just understand that reality, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as I said, you know, the problem of reality begins at home, in your own head. And if you don't start there, then you can't get anywhere.
Defer judgment, you say. Be patient and be humble. It seems like that's another one of the ways of thinking through all of this.
Yeah, all of these things are difficult. I mean, those of us in the liberal cohort are rightly accused of a kind of smugness that is just infuriating and alienating. And I think without challenging one's own strongly held values, One can hold them just as strongly and advocate for them just as vigorously without being so obnoxious about it.
Brooke Gladstone of the program On the Media, which is heard Saturday afternoons at 2 and Sunday mornings at 10 here on KUER. Her book is called The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist and media critic Brooke Gladstone is with us to talk about reality and truth and Donald Trump. Her very short book, an essay really, is about why this moment just feels different. It's called The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. I want to explore, as you do in the book, kind of what's out there, what this current landscape is like. And let's talk about Neil Postman, who wrote the book, of course, Amusing Ourselves to Death. And you call it the most incisive, impassioned warning label ever issued on our media diet. But he wrote this a long time. This was before the internet even became a thing.
Right. And, you know, I wouldn't say that Postman was right about everything. I mean, he said words are always better than pictures, pretty much. And he also said, ever since we got the telegraph going and was able to get news from anywhere, it became entertainment because it was no longer actionable information. It no longer had a definite impact on our lives. It was no longer really relevant to the way that we lived. And, you know, if you go back to the 1600s, you'll find all sorts of trivial stuff in the papers.
Yeah.
And there's that famous Chesterton quote. The news is finding out that Lord George is dead without ever having known who Lord George was, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know that this is, you know, transformational just because we were getting news from outside of our immediate area. I mean, let's face it, we are all connected in ways we never were before, not just through communication, but through business mm-hmm. and finance and exports and imports and culture and agriculture and the environment. All of these things link us in a way they never did before. So I think he was wrong about a lot of things, and also he didn't anticipate what the impact of digital technology would be, and we're still watching that evolve. That is a moving target. We can't even weigh in on that yet. But I thought the part of Postman that I quoted was his comparison of Orwell's 1984, which is just selling off the shelves right now, and Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, right. which was a similarly dystopian view of the future, but a very different one.
Yeah.
I could read you some of that if you want.
I'd love it, because one view is that we are going to be crushed by this merciless oppressor, and the other view is that we basically enslave ourselves by being entertained into submission.
Exactly. What Postman wrote was that Orwell, who wrote 1984, feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared that the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared that we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared that we would become a trivial culture. In 1984, Orwell added, people are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they are controlled by inflicting pleasure. In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us.
Where do you come down? It seems Huxley got it right.
Definitely, definitely Huxley.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that Postman saw that back in 1985. Now, back when Orwell was writing, you know, he was fixated on Nazi devastation, Soviet ascendancy. He would have nailed it then. But now it's unquestionably Huxley, because he portrayed a world, as I wrote, that led ineluctably to the election of Donald Trump.
Yeah. So Donald Trump arrives at a time when you have a media, as you put it, stressed by shrunken audiences and revenue. And so in some ways, as you say, the media was kind of a mark for a candidate like Trump. And, mm-hmm. and one of the questions that comes up is whether Donald Trump's behavior is a conscious strategy or whether he's just being manipulated. Because you seem to believe in some ways that this is a for example, you quote from his book, The Art of the Deal. And this is the quote. The final key to the way I promote is bravado. I play to people's fantasies. That seems like a conscious kind of strategy, that he's actually thinking about all of this. But then there are others who don't think he actually has the intellectual capacity to really pull off something tactical like that. What do you think?
Well, the bravado part of it is unquestionably his own.
Sure.
He is a master of that. And part of the bravado is to simply invent things as you go. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was this classic book, whose title I can't really say on the radio, though it was written by a scholar called On BS, okay?
Right.
And in that book, Dr. Harry Frankfurt argues that lying is generally, you know, because you want somebody to believe one thing other than another. But BSing is simply, you don't care if it's true or not. It simply uses you at the moment. If it's true, fine. If it's not true, fine. So, you know, Trump would recast his bankruptcies somehow as successes. He would, he would exaggerate the number of floors in his towers and the square footage. He would make up numbers and statistics at will, and he continued to do that on the campaign trail. This was all to sell, sell, sell. I don't think that was a manipulation of Trump. I think that is just Trump. Mm-hmm. Now, the part that you could argue about is the reality part, the part that says if you continually say things that aren't true, whether or not you care if they're true or not, if you keep saying them over and over again, and you tell the people who support you that anybody who tells you otherwise has an agenda. And then you revise what you said. And then you basically don't account for that to your followers. You just give them a wink and a nod, like, we're all in on this. We know the game is rigged, but I'm your champion and I'm going to rig it for you. So let's all just cynically assume that we understand that everybody is lying. The truth is not knowable. Mm-hmm. For your purposes, reality is whatever I say it is at the moment. And, you know, let's not split hairs. And by basically claiming dominion over the notion of what is real and what is not, and by disabling the engines of accountability, whether it's the Congressional Budget Office or the entire, you know, mainstream American media, you're basically saying you can't know the truth, so pick whatever you want. You're not under any obligation to look for it. And that opens the way to, that basically signals the end of democracy, because democracy is a negotiation, a tug of war over a common pool of facts. You can argue over what they mean. You can argue about what your goals are. You can argue about the best policies to pass in order to make America better. But you have to agree that these numbers, these statistics, these facts, this evidence is real so that you can negotiate. Once you say you can't know what's real, then you can't negotiate. There's no incentive to. And that opens the door to authoritarianism. And that's where the real danger to democracy comes in. And that is part of the source of the high-pitched whine that I discussed at the beginning of the interview.
You described this relationship between a demagogue and his supporters as a conscious deal, as a bargain. Explain what you mean by that. There's a kind of a give and take going on here. We have an agreement.
Right. Well, you know, let me just say one thing that I didn't discuss in the book is that, you know, there's been a lot of kind of screwy narratives over who was the Trump voter. Mm-hmm. Basically, the Trump voter was the same as the Romney voter. I mean, the vast majority were the same as the Romney voter. It was only on the margins that you saw some of the votes coming from places that may have gone to Obama before, the working class person in the rural area that felt overlooked, that right. There's been so much focus on. Now, of course, Trump only won by a very slender margin, and so those people are significant. But the fact is that most of them were basically the Romney voter, and what they wanted was somebody, anybody, who would enact the kinds of policies that standard Republican bunch of policies. You know, they wanted somebody there who'd help get them through. So that's part of the deal. I'm your guy. You may have wanted someone else. You may have wanted Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio or John Kasich or what have you. But I'm your guy. I'm your best chance. I'm a better chance than Hillary. So, you know, whatever. So Republicans would say, I mean, people on the Hill would say, saying that John McCain was a loser for having been a prisoner of war, that's unacceptable. Or to say that Judge Curiel could not be objective because his parents came from Mexico, that is objectionable. Or to say that it's okay to grab women by their private parts on a tape, that is unacceptable. And in the end, they all folded. Yeah. So there is the deal there. The deal is, you know, it doesn't matter who I am or what I do, I'm there for you. So that's a big part of it. The other part of the deal is simply the one that I mentioned. To those of you out there, that margin that has felt ignored by both parties, that hates the system, that wants to blow it up, that thinks it's irredeemably corrupt, and this I spent a lot of time on in the book, This is our bargain. I will recognize you. I will validate your experience. I will give you good, solid reasons to and people to blame for the situation you're in. And I will help rig the system for you. And all you have to do is believe what I say whenever I say it. And if I change my mind, just know that, hey, you're in on the joke.
Yeah. Before we head into the part of the essay that breaks down how Trump managed to win, a demagogue's playbook, as Cooper put it. We'll get to that. Maybe mm-hmm. would be a good time to point out that you don't actually think Donald Trump is Adolf Hitler or his followers
no.
are Nazi sympathizers.
No, I do not. I do not. I make that very clear in the book.
Yeah.
But his methods were not dissimilar to those that were used by Hitler and the party in demonizing enemies and in creating realities that seemed to make sense to communities that had been in extreme distress since the conclusion of the First World War. Communities that were poorer and poorer and were basically ignored. Mm-hmm. And they felt that the system was irredeemably corrupt. And so when Hitler came along and promised to change things, they were responsive. That all I am talking about are the rhetorical techniques mm-hmm. and the nature of the discourse. I am not talking about the goals or the ends yeah. or the cruelty and massive. I'm not saying I don't. To be honest, in all honesty, first of all, I don't think Trump is anything like Hitler or his followers or like Nazis. But I also don't think that Trump particularly even has a goal in mind.
Yeah.
You know, his views change all the time. They all seem, it always seems to be pretty much, you know, deflecting blame for things that don't go right and continuing what he did when he was a realtor and basically proclaiming how great he is and how effective he is against the evidence. It all seems to be just about Trump Inc. and nothing else. So there's a real distinction for you.
Yeah. Before I want to get to Hannah Arendt here in a moment, but before to talk a little bit, if you would, you don't need to go through all of them, but I think that James Fenimore Cooper's prescriptions for a demagogue are worth mentioning because you go through these. There are four of them, and some mm-hmm. people may be familiar with some of these. One of them is mirror the masses. Maybe start there. Say something about those. I thought they were really interesting.
Authentic. He was authentic.
Yeah.
By speaking his mind, by saying what no one else would say, he seemed realer. He was also saying what a lot of people in his audience believed. He was able to ignite waves of intense emotion. We saw that. Mm-hmm. You know, there was plenty of rough stuff happening on the campaign trail. He uses that emotion for political gain, and he breaks the rules that govern us. That is those famous norms we keep hearing about. Now, a lot of this stuff, any politician has to do to succeed. To some degree, they have to pose as a mirror mm-hmm. of the people they're trying to appeal to. To some degree, they have to ignite waves of emotion and use that emotion for political gain. So I think the crucial one here is break the rules that govern us and pose as a mirror for the masses. I think that those two things were the critical ones there. Michael Signer, who mm-hmm. is a historian, wrote a book called Demagogue, The Fight to Save Democracy from Its Worst Enemies. And he pulled out these James Fenimore Cooper criteria. And he said that for a long time during the campaign, he himself, Signer, did not want to label Trump a demagogue because he didn't seem to mirror the masses or threaten the rules of governance. But then he told us that when he began to openly posture as a mirror and he courted unlawfulness and even violence, that he had crossed that line.
Arendt said demagogues usually begin their careers by boasting of their past crimes and carefully outlining their future ones.
And, you know, didn't we see that during the debates? Didn't, you know, crimes, I think Hannah Arendt probably didn't mean actual, you know, bank robbing or something like that, but Trump, you know, from the debate podium, talked about greasing politicians and how not paying his taxes was smart. You know, sure, I mean, you can find loopholes and do all of those things. But what does it say about you as a person? And not everybody does go through the kinds of exertions that he does to not only pay taxes in a given year to the federal government, although he had to the states, to the New York state, but even to arrange for his past losses, which he would deny having had, to exempt himself from paying for taxes for a decade to come. I mean, this sort of stuff, if you're a rich man, is just so unsavory, but it just showed how he outsmarted the system, and the system is corrupt, and it gets back to that fundamental point that if I can do this for me, folks, I can do this for you.
You're right. It's not the lies that pose the existential danger to democracy. It's the lying.
Right.
That's
what I referred to before about the sense that if you create a state of being in which truly everyone seems to have the right to their own facts, contrary to the famous Daniel Patrick Moynihan quote that everyone has a right to their opinion but not to their own facts, That's over.
Right.
That period is gone. Now that everybody has the right to their own facts, then he can simply address his group by saying, here are your facts. And, you know, that is the end of democracy, as I mentioned. That becomes the law of the jungle.
Brooke Gladstone of the program On the Media. Her book is called The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Brooke Gladstone, the co-host and managing editor for the program On the Media. Her latest book is called The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. Let's talk about the lessons that we learned or should have learned in the media, because this is a part of the book, of course, too. And one of the things you say is that reporters should have mocked and laughed less and reported more. We got blindsided by laughing and mocking Donald Trump.
Right, because what we have to understand, this is something else I believe that Signer said, was that history tells us that, you know, there's a purpose for humor. It can relax you. It can make you feel like you're not crazy, right? But in terms of knocking down the demagogue, I mean, that specific kind of political force, it does not work because he is speaking to his group, his constituents, his supporters, followers, his cohort, whatever you want to call it, in a different way, on a different level. And any time you disparage him, you harden his resolve and those of his followers. You do not weaken them by making fun of him. The only way to really engage a demagogue on his ground is to take his assertions, however absurd they may be, and drill down on whether they are true and whether his policies can even address what he says is wrong. If you don't challenge those things, if you don't challenge them over and over again, you've yielded the field, and jokes don't cut it.
Yeah.
So that was a big mistake. And the media didn't shift to becoming truly investigative and going deep on a lot of his assertions until after he got the nomination.
Yeah. I want to actually play an excerpt in your conversation on the media with Signer about American exceptionalism.
You are optimistic that the American people will overcome what you suggest could be an existential threat to the nation. Why? You're not going to invoke American exceptionalism, are you?
Oh, I am. I wasn't going to, but you got me. Demagogues thrive when we are cynical about truth. they start to deflate when we put faith back again in public reason. And if you look at the history, we have always prevailed. And it's not the checks and balances that we have. It's because the American people, in the end, always choose that demagogues are beneath them.
Is that true, though? Because, I mean, he seems hopeful, but you seem more doubtful. It seems like you would think that that might be kind of a naive way of seeing
things. Okay. Well, let me just say that we had that conversation before the election.
Right.
So, in the end, he was stating a couple of those fundamental, foundational ideas that caused reality for so many people to break. And those are some of those notions about democracy, about truth prevailing over falsehood, we showed didn't prevail in this case. It may have in the past, but it didn't in this case.
So one of the possible, seems like possibly positive outcomes, you say in the book, is that the rules and the formula for making political news might in this era now be reworked and rethought.
Mm-hmm.
Say something about that.
Okay, here's the part that I didn't put in the book, although it's in my previous book, The Influencing Machine, which we talked about a number of years ago. And that is, there was a time when we didn't have to have huge audiences in order to support media operations. In fact, up until the era of television, media had gotten cheaper and cheaper. The printing presses got cheaper and cheaper. The paper got cheaper. So you had a very opinionated press. But television came, reversed that whole trend. Everything got hugely expensive. Not only that, it happened during a time when the country was genuinely under existential threat, during the Cold War period, fear of nuclear annihilation. Not only that, television was using a limited resource, broadcast frequencies, and so they had to answer to government regulation. All of this led to the creation of consensus journalism that was stylistically objective, and I'm putting little weenie quotes around that, because the fact is that basically they created the center and the outliers were marginalized. The discussion was very, very narrow. That this had its good points and its bad points.
Right.
The good points is that it was a civil discussion. We had gatekeepers that could keep absolute crap like the birther stuff from going into the mainstream. This was good. It also kept out things that challenged the status quo. It also enforced a style that was entirely unopinionated. And in fact, especially beginning with the Nixon administration and the creation of a lot of conservative think tanks like Heritage and American Enterprise, this notion that the media were left leaning and that affected their coverage caused the media to bend over backwards to show that they weren't. And that created false equivalencies. I mean, for a long, long time, and again, the sense that the entire scientific community on global warming knew that it was happening and knew that it was partly as a result of man's activities. And then the one scientist paid for by the oil companies saying the other would get equal time. I'm not saying you can't hear from the oil company scientist, but we would give them equal time to basically cover our behinds in this area. Some people call this the golden age. I think there was a big problem with this golden age. So many voices were muted or absent that had important opinions. And now it's everybody's into the pool. And so you have everything good and everything bad that you could possibly imagine. But for the mainstream media, what it's done is it's liberated them to some extent to cease providing false equivalencies. Mm-hmm. To present the story as truthfully as they can without worrying about whether or not people will accuse them of bias. Now, I think that sometimes perhaps some in the media have been drunk with the incredible liberation that they feel, and we may find a little rebalancing happening along the line. But right now, we have a president who says not only are the media biased, but they have no mission. They have no validity. They have their own agenda. They're just a special interest. They provide no meaningful value in the functioning of our democracy. And that gives everyone, okay, there's no way that anybody is going to overcome that kind of constant calumny. So maybe they can just do their job better. At least that's the hope. So in that way, that's a liberation. Another thing that's very important is that people are beginning to understand that if they want good information, they have to pay for it. Yeah. They can't just let their Facebook feed curate it for them. They have to pay for it and not just sort of grab it for free like they have basically since a lot in the media world call the original sin of newspapers posting everything online. So there's that as well. That's the long version.
Not so long. So this brings us to Gulliver's Travels. And you write in the essay that reading the book got you stuck on these two species that Swift writes about. Take us through this, because I think this is a really good way to explain all of this.
Okay, I'll skip over the Laputans, but anybody who wants to really ought to look up the Laputans, because they just show you how cockeyed and weird you can get when you focus on your own narrow reality and see the world. They were basically cockeyed. They saw one eye was focused up, one eye was focused down. But I focused pretty much on the Houyhnhnms, which were these hyper-rational horses.
Yeah.
These were beings that only focused on what they could see with their own eyes. They were governed purely by reason. They didn't need rulers. They didn't need money. They didn't even need a word for lying or opinion, because their universe was so based on a common foundation of observable facts, they never disagreed. Gulliver, as he's traveling, reveres them. He wants to spend his life among them. But they won't let him stay, because even though he is a particularly civil and well-groomed example, he is still a Yahoo, which is the world that Gulliver had traveled to, this depraved, grunting, feral group of humanoids who just robbed and killed each other and ruined their environment, and they were disgusting, and Gulliver hated them. He loathed his resemblance to them. He wanted to stay with the Houyhnhnms, but he couldn't. But one thing that Swift does very interestingly is he shows how even though the Houyhnhnms were so superior in so many ways, they were cold. They had no values.
Yeah.
They had no vanity, but they had no art. They had no philosophy. They had no faith. They had no sense of the aesthetic. They had no joy. They would trade their children, if that seemed the logical thing to do. When it was time to die, they would trot off to die without even spending a single moment on how they lived or even why they'd lived.
Yeah.
And so
this is how you put it, or maybe Swift put it. They do not love or yearn or doubt or mourn.
That was me.
Yeah.
Sounds so good when you read it. Anyway, so but it's all of that. In other words, it's an empty life.
Yeah.
Human beings are yahoos, for sure, but they crave a full life, a life of meaning. And we build our meaning from the stuff that exists outside the realm of observable fact. That's where we began, about beliefs and traditions and history, and in some cases, faith. And aesthetics and philosophy. And those are the things that create our handmade realities. And those are the things that are fragile. Observable fact is just observable fact. The rest of it is fragile, woven together, easily threatened. And once it's threatened, causes terrible distress. So here we are back where we were at the beginning. We need to be able to live full lives with our beliefs intact, while being able to understand that we don't know it all, by being willing to step outside of our bespoke realities long enough to see what's going on out there, if only to make our realities more durable, more able to stand up to the wear and tear of being on the highway with so many other realities like bumper cars crashing into yeah. each other.
And you think there is a path? You say not to agreement, but there is a path to at least comprehension, is how you put it.
Yeah, yeah. I do think if we can just withstand the discomfort of listening to people who disagree, but perhaps whose facts are not utterly rejectable. Mm-hmm. In other words, a lot of people say, hey, I listen, I go out in search of other views. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool liberal, and I watch InfoWars once in a while. Well, you're basically going to the worst possible place, a place of clear and transparent lies, in order to validate your own belief. You know, go closer to home, maybe go to Commentary or the National Review, right? If you are a conservative, then go to places that use good sources and practices for the information. If you want to, go and re-report them. Like an article in the New York Times, they'll often cite papers that you could go and check that data if you wanted to. But don't just deny the data. I mean, data is not perfect. Statistics can lie. But there's in there frequently lies the possibility for the common pool of information that we will need in order to coexist and continue with the great democratic experiment.
Brooke Gladstone, she's co-host and managing editor for the program On the Media, which you can hear Saturday afternoons and Sunday mornings on KUER. Her book is called The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lynn Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.